sitting here, Booth.
I'm sorry. I would have started it 5 minutes ago.
Oh, and I will. I've got two bills up.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Today we are doing an information meeting on reserve funds, and I see Paul is all set up, ready to present.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my favorite topic. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. And I do have some background material for you on reserve funds in Oregon. This is one of the potential issues you talked about on your work plan, and it is a very high priority for your counterparts in the Senate. So we would anticipate that you may see something come over from the Senate in this area. What I thought I would do is kind of give you some background, and there's been, of course, a lot of interest around stabilization funds. With the experience we've had with the economy over the last 10 years. Actually, preceding that, we had a period where economic and revenue growth was very strong in the 90s, and that's when a lot of states developed their reserve funds initially. Oregon was a little late to the party on that, as we'll see, but we now joined that, and there are 47 states that now have a reserve fund, all but Arkansas, Kansas, and Montana. But I just go through the real basic definition. NCSL has done a lot of work on this. They have a number of reports, and they have a detailed breakdown of the reserve funds in each of the states that have available if anybody's interested. But this is their definition. They call a budget stabilization fund. So they want to try to distinguish reserve funds that are really aimed at short-term fluctuations versus those that have more longer-term purposes, like the Alaska Permanent Fund, for example. So the house is administered at the state level. They're intended for state use, not revenue sharing. Their fund is intended for general purposes, although we'll see that they do include our Education Stability Fund as a general purpose fund, even though it is intended for public education in the Constitution. And the fund is intended to offset revenue shortfalls caused by cyclical downturns in the economy. And I think this is one of the real important issues as we look ahead. Is to try to distinguish how much what's going on now in terms of the economy and our revenue stream, how much of that is cyclical and how much of that is structural and long-term. And so that's because a reserve fund is not going to help you with a structural problem. It's really designed to help you through these cyclical downturns when revenue comes back. So the key element of reserve funds, again, is laid out by the NCSL, is legal authorization, and 11 states have a constitutional reserve fund. And then so the other 36 have statutory reserve funds. Some states have multiple funds, and of course Oregon is one of those now, with the creation of the Oregon Rainy Day Fund in 07. So we now have a statutory fund and a constitutional one. Talk about the methods of deposits. This is really, in my opinion, the most critical element because it determines how fast those reserve funds build up. Methods of withdrawals, in order to assure that you have withdrawals that are in which economic and budget conditions warrant it. Number of states have repayment provisions in which if there is an amount taken out of the fund, then there's some repayment provision that would occur when the economy turns around. Fund size is another issue related to the depth and magnitude of downturns, and of course that's an issue that's been revisited with the experience we've had with the Great Recession being the longest recession since 29-33. So here's what our funds look like. And these were both, as you see, were created within the last 10 years. So these are a recent phenomenon in Oregon. The Education Stability Fund was created in 2002. It was actually a failed attempt in spring of 2002 to put a measure on the ballot to convert the Education Endowment Fund, which was created out of lottery revenue in 1995, but was intended for long-term education investments, The Education Stability Fund converted or was changed that endowment fund to a reserve fund, and there's still some remnants of that. One is the Oregon Growth Account, which is a sub-account, which is really not consistent with a reserve fund philosophy where you have to have liquid assets. But in a second attempt before voters in 2002, September of 2002, voters did approve conversion of the Education Endowment Fund to the Education Stability Fund. So that was established. It's in the Constitution now. And then in 2007, the 2007 legislature created the statutory Oregon Rainy Day Fund. And so both of those funds operate independently of one another, but they're our main sources of reserves in the state. The Education Stability Fund has an 18% of lottery earnings, and that's generated between 180 and 200 million a biennium. So it's a significant revenue stream flowing in. One of the issues that's been that you have made adjustments on over the last couple sessions, last session in particular, was that 10% of those earnings, 10% of the 18%, goes to the Oregon Growth Account. And that's intended for long-term venture capital investment. As I said, it's not a liquid asset that you can draw on quickly. You passed a bill last session that reduced that number to 5% for 4 years. So instead of 10% going to the sub-account, now it's 5%. And the numbers you see here are net of the Oregon Growth Account. So they're the true, what we would consider true reserve, because they're put in liquid assets and immediately available. The Oregon Rainy Day Fund, the methods of deposit, there was a one-time corporate kicker credit that was about $317 million that was put in 07. And then there is a general fund ending balance up to 1% of prior biennium appropriations. So, and typically, even when you've had a recession or you've had a biennium that's been dominated by a recession, rebalances and so forth, you still have some ending balance just because we don't know precisely what it is. And so, for example, the ending balance after 2007-09 was about $25 million. And at the end of each biennium, there's reversions from general fund dollars from the agencies back to the general fund. That becomes available. So that there was a deposit, though not a large one.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, isn't there also the, starting, I think it's 2013, the additional 1% on the corporate rate, 7.6 that's going to go in?
Representative Reed, that's correct, yes. I don't have that on here, but that's right. And that's that starts in 2013, so in 2013-15, there would be, if you remember from Measure 67, what that did was it increased the corporate tax rate from 6.6 to 7.6%. And then with the 2013 tax year, it applies the 7.6% only to net corporate income above $10 million. So when it narrows down to that amount, that segment that's generated from those larger corporations, those larger taxpayers, goes into the reserve fund. So that's
it goes into the statutory reserve fund.
Into the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, yes.
Yes.
And isn't the...
Mr. Berger.
Thank you. The 18% after 5%, doesn't it drop, the 18%?
Yes, Madam Chair, the 18%, there's the fund size cap down here, the 5% prior biennium revenue. Once you reach that, then this 18% drops to 15%, and it and the earnings would flow into another sub-account within the Education Stability Fund, which is directed to school capital.
Exactly. Mr. Chair, we haven't reached that point yet.
But actually, we did have... you got fairly close before the Great Recession hit. And we were anticipating it occurring in this biennium. One thing, because you know, there was that surge in lottery earnings associated with the line games coming on, so we were getting bigger revenue growth into bigger deposits into the fund.
But the current state of that reserve is that it's my recollection is $110 million, mm-hmm. rough numbers.
Mr. Chair, I have a slide on that. So.
Oh, you do. Exactly. Okay, we'll get to it. Thank you.
So the other issue is a critical issue for reserve funds is the method of withdrawal. And I always divide these the criteria for withdrawal into three categories. One, a budget-related item. Two, an economic-related. And three, political-related. And all three of them show up in the triggers here. But the key one, really, is the first one, and that is the three-fifths vote in each chamber. Because notice that it isn't or, it's and. So you have to have a three-fifths vote no matter what the other findings are. And indeed, if you look at the bills and have authorized withdrawals, they start out with the legislature finds, and then one of these criteria is listed. The revenue forecast down by 2%, that's what I would call a budgetary criteria, and we meet that condition obviously now. We're down about 8% compared to close of session, so we would clearly meet that criteria. The other issue that's come up is, does it have to be for this biennium? In other words, how could you make a withdrawal for 11-13 based on this finding? And the answer clearly from council, in fact, you've done it in the past, would be yes. You could say you could pass a bill now in this session with a three-fifths vote that said our finding is revenues down 2% below close of session, therefore you could authorize a withdrawal during the 11-13 biennium. And typically what's done is you could make that withdrawal, for example, in May or something of 13. So that might be one of the things one of the possibilities you might be looking at. That was done in 03, for example. And in fact, was done this biennium as well. So the economic criterion is, I haven't written out the full thing there, but it's a payroll employment down two consecutive quarters or two quarters within a 12-month period. And we've met that, still meet that criteria, although we had growth the last quarter of a little over 1%. The last session forecast, which would be the May forecast typically, shows a 3% decline in revenue compared to what's available this biennium. So that would be an extreme case where the economy is in decline.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one point of clarification. So the three-fifths vote is needed and all the other bullet points, or is it and at least one of those other bullet points?
And at least one.
At least one.
I probably should put an or in there for the others.
Okay, thank you.
It's and then or for each of the others. Yes. And, of course, there's the other or at the bottom is the governor declares an emergency. So even if none of those conditions are met, the governor could declare an emergency, and then if the legislature agrees with a three-fifths vote, then that would constitute access to the fund. Now, the rainy day fund, of course, is statutory, which makes these criteria operate a little differently, or potentially. It does require the three-fifths vote, same as the Education Stability Fund. The only difference is it did not include a governor's emergency declaration. That is not part of the rainy day fund findings to constitute a withdrawal. Now, of course, always the danger or the flexibility, I guess you could look at it, around the statutory fund is you could vote notwithstanding and basically override the three-fifths requirement.
And face the political consequences of doing so.
That's exactly right, yes. Yeah. Another element that was included in the Oregon Rainy Day Fund is that withdrawals cannot exceed two-thirds of the beginning balance for any biennium. So the notion there was that there should be, we typically have the impact of recessions carry over into the next biennium, that there should be some constraint on how much can be withdrawn. So only two-thirds can be withdrawn in a given biennium. Neither one of the reserve funds have a formal repayment provision. Of course, they have revenue flows into them, but they don't have a formal repayment provision. And then the fund size, Education Stability Fund is 5% of the prior biennium revenue, which now constitutes around $600 million. And then the Rainy Day Fund is 7.5%. So if you combine the of prior biennium appropriations, so if you combine those two, you have roughly 12.5%, which is a pretty robust reserve fund. If the, of course, the key element becomes not so much the caps, but these are your deposits growing, allowing those funds to grow fast enough?
And do you have a slide on how those caps compare to our actual downturns?
I have something that looks at that, yes.
Thank you.
Yes. So now, if we look at reserve funds, and as I said, Oregon was a little later than the other states to develop its reserve funds, and actually developed in the old 103 downturn. But you can see they've been used extensively in your last two budgets. In 07, 09, basically, at the end of the 07, 09 biennium, the Education Stability Fund was drained. It was emptied, all except for the Oregon Growth Account part of it. So there was a $398 million that was put into the budget. It actually shows up as lottery funds in terms of your budget. And that constituted about 3.4% of general fund revenue for that biennium. So a significant source of revenue in 07, 09 to use to balance the budget. Now going into 09, notice the rainy day fund was not used, but the 09 legislature committed revenue for the 09-11 budget and used, with the February actions, ended up using $340.7 million of that fund. And an additional $84.3 million is committed to the state school fund out of the Ed Stability Fund, and that will be transferred in May of this year. So, and that's part of the $200 million trigger discussion, as you recall, for the state school fund. Now, we've used the Education Stability Fund for the state school fund for K-12, but it's not restricted to that. It's general education, so you could use it for other education-related purposes. Rainy Day Fund is just general purposes. So you got $421 million, or 3.4%, and here's the either the ending balance, or think of it as 11-13 beginning balance. If there are no further withdrawals this biennium, it'll leave you with $101.2 million out of the Education Stability Fund and $10.5 million for the Rainy Day Fund. So the Rainy Day Fund is getting very low, but the total is $116.7 million. So there's still some reserves. Now, of course, the problem, those of us who spend our lives worrying about these things, one of our biggest concerns has been that you get a May forecast at the end of a biennium like the forecast you had last May, which was for the first year of the biennium, in which you saw a $500 million decrease. And that decrease was all based on the 09 tax year. It wasn't a change in the forecast. It was basically an adjustment of what tax returns were showing. So if you had that at the end of the biennium, you'd really have very little alternative except to go to your funds, because you can't really raise revenue and you can't really cut budgets in the last month. So this is it's always good to have some funds available at the end for that kind of contingency. Now, if you look ahead to 11-13, of course, the issue comes up, assuming our forecasters are right that we're going to begin to grow again and we begin to see some positive personal income tax growth over the next couple of years. You can look at what the stream of revenue going into the funds is expected to be. The 18% of lottery is projected to generate $191 million, and so that would leave you an ending balance with $292 million at the end of 11-13. So that's a fairly healthy growth rate. The Rainy Day Fund, the only ongoing source of revenue for the Rainy Day Fund is the ending balance. Right now, that's projected at $65 million. One thing about that ending balance is that typically we'll get more than what's projected because we don't typically account for reversions. We do, but not usually underestimate them. So there's potential for that to go up. Now, of course, the other thing is we've still got, you know, a long way to go for this biennium. We've still got the April tax returns to look at and see if they produce what's expected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed the Education Stability Fund does not reap its own interest earnings. What happens to those?
Representative Brewer, I mentioned earlier that the Education Stability Fund was It was the old Education Endowment Fund that morphed into the Education Stability Fund, and that brought along some different responsibilities. And under the old Education Endowment Fund, the earnings were to be used for needs-based scholarships. They were to be used to retire lottery bonds for schools that had been issued in 97 and 99. So that interest is still committed to that. And that's just a result of history, really. When the Rainy Day Fund was set up, the legislature made a conscious decision, and I remember a very consensus decision to retain those interest earnings. And one of the things that you did is set up the fund so that these balances could actually be used by Treasury for managing the general fund. But at the end of each 30-day period, then there's a calculation done internally, and the interest is put in the Rainy Day Fund. So it is retained by the Rainy Day Fund. That's the $2.7 million.
Thank you. So just to clarify then on the Rainy Day Fund, and thank you, I apologize if you mentioned it, I came in late, my fault. So on the Rainy Day Fund, the interest earnings, it's truly, we're basically allowing the general fund access to the Rainy Day Fund account. It's not sitting in a literal separate account, and then we're self-charging the interest to the fund,
yes.
Essentially.
Exactly. And this, you know, the idea is to, if those balances are available to Treasury, then we reduce our need for external borrowing and keep our interest costs down.
And the discussion on the rate, the internal rate of interest, how is that determined?
The rate of interest is the rate that's on their cash management account. It's like a money market rate, so it's for liquid assets. It's what they would, it'd be their general fund rate.
Zero. Close to it.
The Treasury does not give us any breaks. When we borrow money from the Treasury, he charges us the same as he would charge somebody else.
His budget is coming before my Ways and Means. I'll take a look now. Thank you for that.
Well, it's our policy to that. So
it's our money, too.
It's our money.
Yeah,
that's right.
Thank you.
And, of course, the general fund does receive between $50 and $100 million in interest earnings every biennium.
Yeah.
But then, of course, there are also times of the year when we're short, and he has to go into the market and borrow money in order to make payroll and other things. And that's, as you'll discover in your Ways and Means, that's an expense we have to account for. Yeah. Yes, Representative Vaughn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that was going to be one of my question here is, I mean, how do we cash flow the state government? I'm coming from the city of Troutdale. I know how we cash flow Troutdale. Mm-hmm. But how do we do it with a $1 billion-plus budget?
Well, that may be a
that may be a good topic,
Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking that may be
a good topic. I mean, we haven't had the Treasury in for a clear overview, and that might be a reasonable thing to do.
And also, DAS has developed a cash management model.
That's
where
true.
They look at what monthly cash flow needs are. It has been an issue, and that Treasury has highlighted. You know, if you look at the flow of our revenue, particularly the beginning of a biennium. You know, we don't really start to get large amounts of revenue until we get into the following year, calendar year, and yet our expenses are, starting immediately. So there are cash flow problems. It's one of the issues that's come up in those times when we have large kicker refunds, because those end up going out and following early in the biennium where the cash hasn't come in yet. You know, in the 90s, it goes back to the state's increased commitment to the state school fund to K through 12, and that whole payment pattern changed the way the state spends money or the timing. And in the 90s, there was consistently large beginning balances that kind of masked that. But in the last 4 or 5 biennia, then that's been more of an issue. And that's why the legislature in 2002 gave Treasury the authority to issue these tax anticipation notes for external borrowing, which can be done as long as they're within the scope of a biennia.
Thank you.
Paul, remember in 2003, didn't we do this? Didn't we have a bill in here for warrants because we were down to... Mm-hmm. It was terrifying.
Yes. Well, as you know, our neighbors to the south
have
made
done
a habit
that
of doing that.
I was on the committee then. It was the only year I was on it for until 2007.
It was awful.
It was very fascinating to learn that the treasurer was looking at our warrants law and realizing it hadn't been updated since something like 1919.
Yeah.
So we did update it with the hope that we never had to use it. So far we haven't. And lately, our cash management situation has been much, much, much better than it was in 2003.
Well, Mr. Chair, you were on the committee for just one session, but that one was so long, you got credit for two.
Yeah, it did go on, didn't it?
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is more of a comment. I have been intrigued by continuing to develop my knowledge in this area of matching tax policy, not just with revenue, but tax policy with cash management. And I've submitted some bills specifically to address some of those things that I've noticed, and they're kind of nickel and dimes in the scope of everything. But I talked with the Treasurer's Office as well, and they are very much involved in our debt management. But the cash management seems to be separate, and as a legislator, I would like very much to have it cohesively explained to me, as that is something that would be very important. Important and useful.
I think that's a
totally useful.
Very reasonable idea. Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Wong, did you have something else? No. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So, based on our current projections that you got last week, our ending balance for 11-13 for both reserve funds is about $370 million. So the lessons from the 2000s. In terms of reserve fund management, increasing economic volatility, slow, weak recoveries. And one of the things that I always remind people when they look, when they hear that, well, gee, the recession is technically over now. Well, in the last cycle we had in 2001-03, the recession technically ended in November of 2001. And the legislature had five special sessions in 2002. So really, I mean, that's about when you really start to realize the magnitude of the damage caused by the recession and start to manage, but it's not until it's actually technically over. And the slow, weak recoveries, of course, have complicated that. The revenue volatility has increased, and the revenue unpredictability has increased, and I'll show you some indications of that. Just in terms of the employment, we've come through a period in the last decade where we've had two stretches where we've had declining employment. And that's the only time that had happened in the post-war period was in 80, 81, and 82. So this is, and then we've had twice within a decade. So again, the recessions, you can see, for example, even the 07-09 recession that was 19 months long, it ended in mid-09, and still we have another year of declining employment. And that was also the pattern, in, as I said, in 2001, the recession technically ended in 01, November of 01, and then we end up with two more years following where we're technically in recovery, but our employment is continuing to decline. So those weak recoveries have put added strain on the budget and prevented revenue growth from responding very quickly. In terms of the volatility, we always keep this chart based on the data. Actually, this is from the Rockefeller Center. They keep track of the major revenue sources of the states. And you can see the three major sources. Corporate income is by far the most volatile, peaking with a 60% increase in 2005. These are quarter year-over-year growth. And you can see declining by about 20% in the current recession. But, of course, the corporate's not very big. It's a lot smaller than the other two. Personal and sales are about the same nationally in terms of the revenue generated. And you can see the volatility. Personal income has consistently shown more volatility with drops of 20% in the 2001-03, the depth of the 2001-03 recession, and about 25%, actually I think that's 27%, at the depth of the 2007-09 recession. So that gives you a magnitude of the depth there that income taxes will fall, and I'll show you ours in a minute. It's very close to that. Sales taxes don't tend to drop as much, but of course they don't grow as much during an expansion. So you see a tighter band there. But it also suggests that an income tax state like Oregon, you have the advantage of stronger growth and the disadvantages of bigger decline. So that, of course, has implications for reserve fund policy. And here's, of course, my favorite chart that you've all seen. The big red bar showing how important the personal income tax, 73% of state tax collections, the highest percentage, and the highest percentage of reliance on any single tax.
Thank you, Mr. Kosher. You know, we've looked at this in a couple of different ways, and I also like this chart a lot. I think it tells us a lot of things, but I think that there's a shortcoming there, and I don't know if there's a way we can fix this. But I know that when you're talking about an S-corporation, an LLC, or another disregarded entity at the federal tax level, that gets reported in our numbers and on these charts as personal income tax. I'm wondering if there is a way that you can segregate that out for us so that we can see what percentage of our revenues are coming from true employees and what percentage of our revenues are coming from the owners of closely held disregarded entities.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Wan, yes, we can do that, and we can separate out all of those components in detail. And, of course, recall when we looked at the Ernst & Young business tax study, they broke that out and counted that as business taxes. And we can certainly do that. But I also think it's important to remember that that's also a big source of instability within the income tax, is that business component, because, in down years, that can drop way off, as we've seen in recent cycles. So it is a reason for this source fluctuating a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't agree more. My point is just as we look at our tax policy and as we look at policy objectives in this legislature, one of the things I believe we have to do is fully consider how our actions affect small and closely held businesses, because right now those are a big driver of the economy, mm-hmm. and yes. It would be helpful to me in making those decisions to have that segregated out. So, mm-hmm. Thank you.
We'll do that. And here's the pattern we've seen. This is everything we count as personal income tax revenue coming in net of refunds. And you can see that if you look at our experience over the last 10 years, it monitors what we saw, reflects what we saw nationally for the personal income tax. And, of course, the difference is that this is almost 90% of our general fund. You can see that we had drops in the 2001-03 period, in which we're down about 20% during that. And see, the 2002, the second quarter of 2002, was one of those times I remember well, because we hadn't really had much experience with drops of this magnitude until that point. And, I remember talking to the Department of Revenue, and they said, basically, that's it. You're not getting any more final payments. We're done. And we thought, you can't be done now. Then it was down about 20%, and of course, that led to a June special session. And you can see that growth popped back up, though, to 10 to 20% in the mid part of the decade, and then again, the drop is about 30% this biennium, the second quarter of 2009, being the reflection of those 2008 tax year, which the market plummeted and we saw unemployment jump so rapidly. And notice that even though in the second quarter of 2010, you saw this big drop in the forecast, but it was not so much that revenue had dropped, but is that it wasn't growing as fast as was assumed, wasn't coming back as fast. Now, if you look at the unpredictable revenue stream, and this was the other lesson of the last decade, these numbers are not quite pure in the sense that the actuals do account for actions that you took during the interim, during special sessions, for example, that may have affected revenue. But generally, the actions that you took actually narrowed in those down years what the margin of error was, because you took steps to try to raise revenue. That was particularly true in 2001-03, for example, where the $450 million appropriation credit bond that was sold in the spring of 2003, that counted as revenue. So if you don't include that, that estimate was off by about 20% instead of 15. So you can see the magnitude there. And of course, this has obvious implications when you look at the cap discussion about what's an appropriate cap. And you've had basically three biennia in the last 10 years where you've had when you've been between 8 and 15% below forecast.
What are the adjustments for 7.9 and 9.11? You've indicated one for 1.3.
Well, there was some revenue adjustments for 09-11, for example. As you recall, in February, you went in and made adjustments on the Betsy. That ended up generating about $50 million. There was some fund shifts, fund sweeps, as LFO calls them, from other fund accounts that went into the general fund. That shows up as general fund revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing major, but I think it was... Your February actions increased the general fund by about $118 million, I think. So that shows up there as revenue. So you would have been $118 million more. This would have been 1268 instead of 1150.
Okay. It might be helpful if there was another column that had the percentages, well, maybe two more columns, the differences without the adjustments.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If the borrowing in 0103 counts as general fund revenue, take it out and show us what the general fund tax receipts plus OLCC and the other few things that normally go into it actually account for.
Mm-hmm.
And give us that number, because that percentage is closer to the one that ought to be related to what we end up with in the constitutional rainy day funds when you add them all together.
Mr. Chair, we have done that, and it was right about 20% was the difference.
For 9/11, both of these are down.
Yes.
You almost have to sum them in order to deal with the size of the rainy day fund in order to make sense out of it.
And the sum
is more than just adding those two numbers. Mm-hmm. It's taking the 5.7 number and adding in a second time the down amount in 7.9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and remember, one of the things that the Office of Economic Analysis has done that's interesting is point out that the part of the difference between these two downturns was just the timing. The last recession kind of hit in the last year of last biennium, the first year of this biennium.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at those two fiscal years, these numbers are down about 20%.
Right. Thank you.
And I will also, Mr. Chair, going further back in history, I think relevant for the cap discussion, there were a lot more aggressive actions taken in 81-83, particularly the what ended up being called a surcharge, but it was just an increase in rates. If you adjust for that, that forecast error was right about 20% as well. So that's kind of the low water mark in terms of how far the forecast has been off in the last 40 years, right about 20%. But you can see also notice the pattern that even when 0103 was contained within that recession, we're still low in 0305, although part of that had to do with the failure of the Measure 30.
But my point, I think, is that that's compared to 0103, isn't it?
The 0305 number there is compared to close of session forecast.
Okay, all right.
So these are looking at this is looking at predictability.
Right. If your object is to try to maintain a steady state budget, more or less, something close to that, then you almost have to go back to the last time you had a steady state and make the comparisons from there.
Yes.
Which would give you different numbers than the ones you've got here, wouldn't they?
Yes.
I don't know how much different or which direction, but...
You're right, Mr. Chair. And, of course, the thing that we've been wrestling with lately is to try to get a sense of what the underlying trend is now. I mean,
we don't think it's changed,
yeah. You know, and it's gone down, but how much? And so that really makes it difficult.
Well, J.P. Morgan had it right when he said, stocks fluctuate. Economies fluctuate too.
Yes. Okay, reserve fund issues going forward. A lot of discussion about rebuilding reserves, and I think that issue and being discussed in the Senate in particular, that revolves around the rainy day fund, where you can see that the deposit going in is $65 million. That's assuming that forecast holds for that. For that ending balance, but that's a relatively small amount going into that fund. Adequate size of reserves. And this is something that the Task Force on Revenue Restructuring in the last interim spent a lot of time working on in the interim before 09 session. And their conclusion was that it should be anywhere from the 10 to 15%, and we're about 12.5 now. I think there's interest in raising that in light of the experience of the last two biennia. And, of course, again, though, the issue becomes not so much there's the cap issue, but, you know, you can make a cap 50%, but if you don't have, an adequate revenue source going in and have it growing during periods of growth, then it's not going to matter. The other thing, of course, is that we all know that the 07-09 budget period and the 09-11 budget period in particular would have been a lot worse without very aggressive federal fiscal policy, and the issue is what's the future role of that and how much can we expect in that. And then finally, it's important to keep in mind that this reserve fund issue is separate and distinct from the issue of long-term revenue trends. And of course, Governor Kulongoski, with his reset cabinet, the committee heard, is really dealing with those longer-term structural trends. This is a separate issue. And there's no reason to believe, even if we have lower trend growth in the future, that we've dropped to a lower rate than what we've seen in the last several decades, there's no reason to believe it'll be any less volatile. We could have just as much volatility around a lower trend. So both of these concerns, I think, are going to influence your revenue policy for a long time to come. Okay. That's all I have. Now, I asked the Treasury to be here. I don't see them. I'd ask them to follow up and give us a little discussion, but I don't see them here. So,
do you want to stand at ease and check in with them and see if they're coming?
I don't see them, so I would not.
You would not expect that?
I would not expect them to be here. So,
Further comments, discussion, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have mentioned this, but I had former Senator Packwood in my office yesterday, and he remarked upon his years in the legislature way back, and he indicated that in those years they enjoyed the surplus every year, so the discussions were much more enthusiastic about spending money. I noticed the charts didn't go back as far, that far, and I guess my question to you is, what has changed in a nutshell? What's changed? Is it because of the timber situation? Is it because of our tax? What's changed?
Representative Benz, in terms of what's changed in terms of the state fiscal situation, and well,
from excuse me, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
from the standpoint of a structural revenue situation, what's different?
Well, Representative Benz, I think there are several things. The most important change that we've experienced in Oregon that's affected our revenue is just slower, weaker national growth. And two recession, particularly very deep recession. The best predictor for our short-term fluctuations is the national economy. We've never had a period where we had a recession where there wasn't a U.S. recession, and we've never had a period where the U.S. went into recession that we didn't. So that's the best predictor. We're closely tied, given our revenue, given our structural economic mix. And I think the most important explanation for that is that we have, if you look at our gross state product and the value added we have in durable goods manufacturing industries, which for us would be tech, lumber and wood products would be in that, but it would be high technology, it would be transportation equipment, it would be aircraft parts, it would be, you can think of the big companies that rail car manufacturing, those kinds of things, a motor coach, they're all within this durable goods category. If you look at our percentage of our economy tied to that, it's double the U.S. average. It's about 16% of our gross state product is in durable goods manufacturing, about 8% U.S. So that's where we get more volatility. When the economy goes into recession, we tend to go in more because of that structure. So I think that's kind of the nature. It's really kind of the nature of our niche. I mean, we're basically a goods and distribution based economy where we're producing goods and distributing them to large markets to the north, south, and across the Pacific. So we're going to be tied to that trade and that activity very closely. When it's doing well, as it was in the 90s, we tended to do well. The other issue that affects us and affects our revenue stream a lot is what our growth is relative to other areas, particularly California. And if those growth differentials get so that we're becoming more attractive, we'll get that in-migration wave. And that had a big effect on the 90s. And, of course, that, for example, the 89-91 recession was a fairly mild one nationally, but hardly a blip in Oregon. And the reason was because that was a peak of in-migration we had from California in that period where we, in 91, was our peak year of net migration. So those factors came into play to offset some of the cyclical patterns. But in general, it's the U.S. economy and the problems that the U.S. economy has had that have been the biggest source of weakness for us, I think, in the last 10 years. We've lost some ground in terms of our per capita income that's gotten a lot of concern from people. But I think that had to do with our industry mix, and those industry mix that we have, they're export-oriented, have not done as well because of the international trade patterns.
Well, there are two thoughts. One, you had a chart 2 years ago that showed the net in-out migration. It would be great to see that chart again. I don't know what year it was that chart reflected, but it was very interesting. The second question, the first question, is do you see the fluctuations that we've enjoyed over the past 8 years changing, or do you see it becoming more pronounced?
Representative Vance, I think that again, it's, you know, those if the U.S. economy makes some structural changes that I think are in response to the problems that have developed in the last 10 years. I would see those as major positives for Oregon. In particular, if we turn to a growth model in the U.S., it's more export-oriented, more capital goods-oriented, which I think is a very real possibility. That would be the logical adjustment to make away from consumer spending and away from housing that we had in the last decade, then Oregon would really be well positioned, and I think we'll do better as a result of that. But I do think, though, given the world economy we're in now, given the fluctuations that we've seen in commodity prices, for example, I think the volatility is not going to go away. I think it'll be more volatile. I don't think we're going to have the recession we had that we've just come through is pretty unique, and that had to do with a buildup of debt and problems that accumulated over a 10-year period or more. And that kind of financial sector-induced recessions, those tend to be more severe. So I don't think this last recession was typical, but I think we'll have more recessions like the 2001-03 type downturn.
Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you started out the presentation by saying that a reserve fund is good if you're making a bridge to somewhere. And the thought would be, the obvious question is that a design, a device that you think fits our future better than some other arrangement? Because the concept is, of course, that there's an up and there's a down, there's an up and there's a down. And so, thus, if we had a reserve fund, we'd fill in the down. But it doesn't make any sense, particularly if there isn't that following up. So you're basically, I guess I'm asking, is the reserve fund device the proper solution to what we've just been shown, or the most efficient solution to what we've been shown?
Representative Benz, what I was trying to say is I think when this last point about ability to distinguish between cyclical and structural revenue trends, I think that if we're in a period, and I think we are in a period where our longer-term trend has been reduced, I don't think a reserve fund is going to solve that problem for you. There's going to have to be some longer-term adjustments that are made either in through the budget or through the revenue system to respond to that. However, that trend may be lower, but I think we're going to have fluctuations around that trend, given our dependence on the personal income tax, and we know its nature. For example, this last recession we went through, the changes nationally in the personal income tax were more than double in percentage terms than changes in the sales tax. So we've got that revenue system, and it's likely to be the one we have for a while to come. So I think that just means that reserve fund policy becomes very important in that kind of system. And I think the volatility is still going to be there. So a reserve fund system, it will be very important for you to deal with that. It's not going to solve your structural problems.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other discussion today on the reserve funds and?
Can I say something about the schedule?
Yes, on the schedule, please.
We've gone to a 9 o'clock start tomorrow, so hopefully there won't be a problem.
I have further information. I just got called out by the staff of our speakers. they are very concerned not only about tomorrow, but the next day looks possibly worse.
The weather.
They wondered if it is possible, since we are authorized to vote by phone, because tomorrow we have exactly one item on our agenda, and it is a very important item and a very timely item. So I said, you need to understand that about a year ago, my husband fulfilled his apparent lifelong dream of getting the biggest pickup truck you've ever seen.
Amen.
And as a result of the fact that I live 3 miles from here, I think I can get here.
It will bring you.
Okay. With that, it's finally going to prove its usefulness. And and so if through Paul we can make arrangements for those of you who cannot get here to by phone be here, I think we can get our work done tomorrow.
I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Okay.
Paul, if you could see that we have facilities and that people have a number to call in the event that they're unable to be physically in the building because of the weather,
yes,
would be helpful.
Then it is anticipated that we can conduct our one bit of business tomorrow somehow. So have your staff alert to hear from Paul about how that...
So your homework is to read the bill in advance and be prepared to ask questions.
Yes.
So what we'll do is we will set that up and we'll send you an email, so we'll have a number for you to contact. And we'll just set it up right here.
And we'll have a speakerphone here, right. Microphone attached to the public address system so that other people can follow along. And
it's at 9.
And we're meeting at 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock, and of course the bill is Senate Bill 301.
A.
301A.
Yes, they did amend it, yes.
Yes.
Yes. All right. We're obviously going to continue this discussion on reserve funds and on the issue of cyclical versus long-term structural changes in the economy. One of the things that we know, and I made a little joke a little while ago, but I don't mean to be flip. The reality is that the American economy is enormously resilient, and we have been through very, very bad times in the past. This recession has been coming for a long time. I mean, last year, and maybe you want to bring that chart again, Paul, you showed us the inflation-adjusted single-family dwelling price since about 1900, and it looks like a line that starts out basically flat and then becomes basically vertical. And of course, that line was chopped off pretty abruptly a little bit ago. I wouldn't personally be terribly surprised if it takes a long time to get that home price adjustment where it needs to be in order for people to get back to the system of being able to afford a house for their families to live in, and therefore there may be more wrenching adjustments to the price, the average price of a home, and because Oregon's economy is so tied to home construction nationwide, that it wouldn't surprise me at all that this becomes a major issue for us for a long time. Now, that's the most negative view, I think, that I have of the economy. The other side of it is that if you've been reading the articles, as I have, about the innovations in the manufacturing economy and in other kinds of things, the United States is very well placed to participate in the next major economic development, which is, I don't know what they call it, but basically non-mass manufacturing based on 3D printing and other things of that sort. So I don't think that it's wise for us to be pessimistic about the long term. I think it's very wise of us to recognize that the long term is likely to look quite a bit different than what we have lived with in our lifetimes up till now.
Mr. Chair, and I would add too that we have consistently had the forecast that even though on a per capita basis we tend to lose ground, but in terms of overall growth, Oregon's going to grow faster than the rest of the country, just because of our location. We're going to be a net attractor state, and we're going to have 20 years from now, we will have grown more than the country, and that's I think
in population.
That's a pretty wide consensus. Well, in terms of jobs, in terms of income, in terms of population, yes.
Even if the per capita growth isn't there,
yes.
Can you tell us? When the last time was that we actually had negative, using the economy's negative growth rates in population?
Mr. Chair, that was in the early 80s.
So right through all these recessions, mm-hmm. right through all these downtimes, right through all these periods of unemployment, people have continued to move to Oregon.
Yes, and the best predictor of short-term migration trends is not our unemployment rate, but it's really our unemployment rate compared to California. And even though we're still at 10.6, they're at 12.6. So we're an attractive state. In fact, I think we would have stronger in-migration if it wasn't for the difficulty of selling houses and the mobility's been restricted because people can't sell their homes.
Mm-hmm. Similar to the problem we've been talking about involving the senior property tax deferral program.
Yes, exactly.
Anything, Representative Betts?
No, thank you, Chair. Too good an opportunity to pass up to when we have the former state economist. So lots of interesting activity in the Middle East, and it looks as though gasoline prices may go up sharply. How much of an impact on the state of Oregon?
Versus the rest of the country.
Exactly.
Yes, and we do know, Representative Benson, that will affect your travel costs more than anyone else on the committee.
But, Mr. Chair, if I may, thank goodness I have studded snow tires, because that will allow me to stay out of the ditch and keep moving.
Yeah,
and make it to the meeting
legal?
Tomorrow.
Are they legal?
And you may not get home as often as you'd like.
But in terms of commodity prices, yes, we are in an interesting cycle where we still have very low inflation estimates expected for the U.S. and for the kind of industrial world, but inflation is really picking up in the emerging economies. China, India, Brazil are all experiencing inflation in 5-7% range, and those commodity price increases are not just oil and gas, but it's food, it's cotton prices have gone up, metals prices. So as the emerging economies have grown faster, the demand for those commodities to increase sharply. And I think we're in for a period where commodity prices, of course, will fluctuate a lot, but I think the trend is clearly up, and including oil prices. And, of course, if we get those spikes in oil prices, who have remember back to the 70s, you can date a lot of the recessions, immediately preceding by an oil spike. And, there's some economists who argue that even the Great Recession that's been so much associated with the financial crisis, that one of the things we forget about is the $4 a gallon gas that preceded it in 08. So that may have been a contributing factor. Oil prices are definitely a risk in the short term for the U.S. economy because it essentially acts as an excise tax on the oil-consuming countries like us, and it just, you know, it removes dollars out of the system and will slow our economy. So it's clearly a risk.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, demonstrates all the more why our long-term policy to become as independent energy as we can makes sense. So that we can reduce the influence of these kinds of commodities. Of course, the other side of that, too, that we don't talk about very often is that the United States is a major commodity exporter. And when wheat prices go up, eastern Oregon and eastern Washington do quite well. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, U.S. is the number one exporter in food. So, I mean, you know, with higher food prices, that's a net plus.
Yeah. Thank you. Anything else this morning? Thank you, Paul. We really appreciate the update. And remember, we're meeting at 9 o'clock tomorrow.
Yes.
If the snow is really bad, come by phone.
Okay. Yeah. We do have a full set of public hearings for Friday, so we'll just kind of stay tuned.
We'll try to
stay tuned on that.
And of course, remember, public hearing means we're hoping for people to come to the Capitol to make presentations, and if they're unable to get here, that becomes a problem for us.
Yes, that's true.
Yes, yeah. And I do have some folks heading down to Salem on Friday. They're scheduled. So I'll let staff know and everything.
Well,
we'll have to play it by ear. And I tell you, I personally don't want people traveling on dangerous roads when changing our schedule a day one way or the other could make all the difference.
Well, we can talk.
We'll figure that out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Stay in contact so that you can, if we make plans quickly, you'll be in the loop.
I will.
All right. Thank you. With that, the committee is adjourned.